I'm Humphrey Hawksley, and thank you for joining the Magazine Show podcast brought to you by Golster, the experts in health and well-being, with a range of fascinating guests who stimulate, educate, and make us laugh. Hello and welcome to our live audience and to our podcast listeners. I am Humphrey Hawksley, your host for the next hour on the Golster Magazine Show, where we are going to talk about keeping ourselves and our communities safe. The headlines are filled with stories about war and the future risk of it, reaching our doorsteps, whether by terrorist bomb or nuclear attack, or closer to home, a mugging or a knife attack. What exactly is our individual responsibility? My guest today has worked and thought deeply on all of this. As a younger man, he was part of the famous SAS Special Forces, but, and this is an important but, as a reservist and not as a full-time career soldier. What is the difference? How does this reservist system actually work? He went on to join our great democracy as a member of parliament, became a government minister, and remains at the forefront of helping to keep our country and communities as safe as can be. We're very lucky to have him. Welcome, Sir Julian Brazier, to Golster Magazine Show.
Thank you, Humphrey. It's a great pleasure to be here.
It's great to see you. I think we should tell our audience that we have the spaceship type of background for you because of the Northern Lights, which have been streaking across Britain and are going to become part of our conversation as we go down on it because of their magnetic pulses. But before we get there, we read about every day, we're reading about Russia and Middle East and China and all the rest of it. How unsafe are we, Julian, in a nutshell, in our houses? How unsafe are we at the moment?
I don't want to frighten people, but making preparations against the things that can go wrong is the best way to be safer. And in the case of the man-made stuff, it also makes it less likely that it'll happen. We have a major war in Europe. I was privileged to be over in Ukraine, seeing how ordinary people are managing to continue ordinary lives over there, despite repeated bombardment in eastern and southern Ukraine. We have a new power emerging in China, which is rivaling the United States and has taken over large parts of our social media. Iran, in the news a lot, with the various threats it provides. And of course, there's the Daesh and Al-Qaeda terrorism. And waiting to come back. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, so we're sort of aware of it, and most of us sort of read it, and it becomes familiar, but we're not actually sure what it means and how it impacts us. So over the next 45 minutes, we are going to have 45 minutes of conversation for our podcast, and then we're going to cut off, and our audience can talk directly to you on anything that concerns them or doesn't concern them after that 45 minutes. But I want to go from the headlines to our homes, as it were. So the headlines, as you said, is about Russia, the Middle East, China. All of them are seen as threats. But again, for us, is it right or is it overblown? Are we getting unnecessarily worried?
Well, getting worried is not per se a good thing, but it becomes a good thing if it means doing something about it, Humphrey. And the reality is that the more that a country and an individual household, communities, households prepare, the less likely it is that things will go wrong and the better equipped they are to deal with it. I mean, to give just a few examples of just how vulnerable we are, this is an island. Something that wasn't even mentioned in the first national security statement many years ago when I was an MP. 97% of our goods arrive by sea, as our regular Royal Navy likes to remind us. But that means 97% of our goods come through ports, and the vast majority of them have no protection of any kind. Our coastline, the vast majority of our software traffic, of our digital traffic, comes through cables which come across our coastline. There's no protection for them, although we've just bringing into service a couple of extra survey ships to see what's going on there. All our nuclear power stations are on our coastline. These are examples of the kind of vulnerabilities which are easily threatened. Coming closer to individual homes, the one bit where the government has moved a long way in terms of getting people moving is with the cyber strategy and the national cyber effort. But in our individual homes, are we asking ourselves, and we need to ask ourselves, what do we do if the internet goes down completely? What do we do if the power goes down completely? The rather garish background behind me reminds us of the Northern Lights, quite friendly when we're just looking at them. But if we had something like the Carrington event in the 19th century, which fried a lot of the telegraph wires of the time, it would probably knock out the whole of the internet for a period of weeks. So these are all the sorts of things we need to be thinking about.
Let's divide that into two, if we could, because the home thing is really our individual responsibility. Yes. The ports and the cables, that's the government, isn't it? And when we see in the headlines British troops training and helping out in Ukraine, the pilots shooting down people in the Middle East, and then how much the army is being depleted or increased, and whether we're buying battleships and the rest of it. What you've just said is something very different, isn't it? The nuclear power stations, the ports, the internet, and that.
Yes, I mean, when the Ukrainian war broke out, within 2 weeks, they were able to put 200,000 reservists under arms. And to give one example, most people read about the heroic siege of Mariupol, where the Azov Brigade fought virtually, I mean, to the bitter end. They were reservists. That was an entirely reserve brigade. We haven't got 200,000 reservists. We've got a bigger population. So when we talk about the size of the army, it's not just the regular army. It's also the whole question of how much can we mobilize from the wider population.
Just to encapsulate, what is a reservist exactly? You were one. You began your soldiering career as one. How does a reservist differ from a full-time soldier?
Well, volunteer reservists, which is what I was, are people who have civilian jobs. We've got about 35,000 of them in this country. There's also the strategic reserve of ex-regulars and reservists who could be called on but don't train regularly. So these are units. I was in one of the two reserve SES regiments. You have reservist infantry and sappers and so on. Now, in both world wars, we went to war with a territorial army, as it was then called, which was larger than the regular army at the time, as was the case in Ukraine today. The reservist is somebody who effectively leads, in Bill Slim's famous expression, is twice a citizen. He's doing a civilian job, generating wealth for the country, but also is serving part-time in uniform.
So give us your story, Julian, since you're a young man, you're going to school, you're thinking that you want to do a job and you want to be in the military. What was your thought process and then what actually happened when you became one?
Yes. Well, it can start at university. The opportunity is to join the University Officer Training Corps, which is part of the reserves, or the naval equivalent, the ERNU, or the Air Squadron, the Air Force. And then from there, go on to join. You don't have to have been through an OTC. You can join directly, as I did, into a reserve unit. So I remember my job in the city. Monday to Friday, I'd be sitting at my desk working really quite hard for a mining finance company, thinking about deals and so on. And then by 10 o'clock on a Friday night, I might well be in the guts for Hercules waiting to parachute on an exercise. And it was jumping into Denmark or wherever it happened to be. And this kind of leading two careers at once is very, very demanding, and it puts a stress on the families. But it's also immensely worthwhile for the individuals. Most of my best friends came through were comrades at one time or another.
So you're in this. I'm just thinking from the employer's point of view. You know, you're running a company, and Julian Brazier is cutting deals and doing all this, and then suddenly something happens. The military has got the priority to take you off that job and use you.
Yes, but there's a very clear deal which goes well beyond anything that's written in law on this, which is that the military will be reasonable, except in extremis, there will be a consultation process where it is in extremis, then there's still an appeal process even then. We have a very long list now of employers who have signed up to the Armed Forces Covenant to support their reservists. Every trust in the NHS has signed up to it. The Central Civil Service has signed up to it. Almost every local authority has signed up to it in the public sector, in the private sector. All the clearing banks, all the supermarkets, all the big accounting firms are signed up to it, and so on. The people it's most difficult for are small businesses, and there has to be a recognition that in some cases people shouldn't really be reservists because they're completely indispensable. They're the only person in a small business with a particular skill. But large numbers of our reservists come from small businesses too.
And
there's a big plus. There is one really big plus. And that is that typically reservists, and if you talk to any employer who's got them, are among the most enthusiastic, among the least likely to take time off work for sickness, among the least likely to be skivers.
And how does the money work? If you're called off to go and be deployed somewhere for 2 months or 3 months, does the army pay you or does your company pay you?
The army pays you, and if there's a big difference between what you would have been paid in civilian life, the army will, up to a reasonable cap, pay you the difference. There's also, and I was strongly in favour of this, we copied this idea from the Australians, who have a proportionately much bigger army reserve. There's also a supplementary payment which small businesses can put in for that they will get an additional payment on top of that, as well as compensating them for costs of hiring in a stand-in and so on. They'll get a no-questions-asked bonus as well.
So, you mentioned the siege of Mariupol and how that was carried out by reservists in the Ukrainian army. What is the difference in thinking? So if you're going from being a dentist or being a mining negotiator or something, as opposed to being a full-time soldier, are you bringing something new? And is it being bought? And the reason I ask this is Finland, the newest NATO member, 97% of his military are reservists. In the UK, it's just 18%. So should we have more or should we, how does it work?
Yes. I mean, I've written a series of papers for RUSI. I think there is at last a recognition just beginning to come that it's out of balance. Our reserve forces are much too small a proportion of the total. I mean, if you take the army, for example, more than half the US Army is National Guard and their federal equivalents, US Army Reserve. The regulars are less than half. More than a third of their fast jet fighter force is reservists. In Britain, reserves are only just over a quarter of the total army. Australia and Canada are much closer to the American balance.
And how does that, when there are sort of thinking about how to restructure, modernize the military, how would the reservist thinking differ to the full-time soldier thinking?
Well, two parts to the answer. First part, where we've had it very muddled for the last few years has been the idea that you use reservists as individuals or small groups to pad up regular units, which is what we started doing at the end in Afghanistan, and it had a terrible effect on the reserve units. People joined to fight with their mates. There is now a recognition, and it's very clear that reservists will form the second echelon. So your regulars the first echelon, the reservists the second echelon, and then the strategic reserve and the wider civilian population make up the citizen army, which the chief of the general staff was talking about in a very good speech in February.
Yes.
Second part of the answer is difference in thinking. Reserve units obviously need a bit longer to come up to being ready for war than regular units, but they tend to bring a different kind of thinking to it. The SES was set up by people in the Second World War who were either reservists like David Stirling or civilians like Jock Lewis, who was the captain of the Oxford rowing team, and Paddy Mayne, who was another pre-war civilian. There were no regulars involved in the original formation of the SES, for example. They brought a new way of thinking.
That's interesting. So they came in with, as you say, a new way of thinking, and that idea to create an SAS had not come through the mainstream traditional military thinking. It had come in from the outside. Okay.
The very first, I don't often boast about it, but the very first, small group sort of specialist operations were carried out by a little sapper TA unit called the Kent Fortress Royal Engineers, which my grandfather, who was a First World War veteran, had raised from his cement works. And Churchill, actually, as First Sea Lord, said he wanted a TA unit to do this job, destroying all the oil installations in small parties along the coastline of France and the Low Countries, because he thought reservists would bring a different kind of thinking. And the unit that was selected, the War Office managed to send off with their division. So at the last moment, my grandfather's unit were brought in to do it, and they destroyed 2 million tons of oil.
Goodness, so it's in the blood, as it were. And that interesting there, because we have a question or a comment in from Ewan Grant on the earlier thing you mentioned about the ports, which we've just come back to. And I went, when he said, see cyber attack against Rotterdam, the largest port in Europe before the pandemic and full-scale invasion. Are you aware of a thing against Rotterdam?
I saw the report in the papers, but I don't know anything that's not in the public domain. But of course, there are lots of other ways to attack a port. You could put sea mines, which are extremely cheap and widely available, into the water. You could even threaten that you've done so. Traditionally, the defence of ports was very much a reservist function. If you look at what happened at the beginning of the Second World War, the Royal Navy had then, as it has now, focused on sea lanes and all the distance stuff. And we had very little protection against mines and very little protection against the highly effective German E-boats, which raided on the surface. We had to hastily regenerate units out of various reserves, the RNVR principally, and also a specialist reserve of yachtsmen to tackle it.
And how does that compare to the situation or the picture you painted at the beginning, whereby we've talked about the military and the army and that, but these, the ports, the nuclear power stations, the electricity grids and those sort of things, who is responsible for keeping those safe? It's not the military, is it?
Well, the short answer to that is, I refer to my RUSI paper I wrote with Admiral Chris Hockley on maritime reserves. It's on the RUSI website. It's not at all clear. The Navy is only responsible. It certainly should be clear. And to its credit, the government introduced 18 months ago what it calls the UK Government Resilience Framework, which is mostly just a piece of paper, but it's already been updated once, which is a growing recognition that we don't yet have a national defense plan in the way that Finland, which you mentioned, has. But this is the embryo of it. And it crucially talks about regular forces, reserve forces, voluntary organizations, the wider business, and so on. And that's what you would need to provide protection for the coastline. It can't be done by regular forces alone.
In recent history, because you've been in government, so you know how it works, and we've had, say since 2015, we've had the threats from China. I think they stole our Ministry of Defense documents the other day or something like that. We've had Russia threatening to drop nuclear bombs on us. We've got terror threats and everything like this. Despite all this time, say since 2015-ish, the government has not come up with a piece of paper that says, you protect the nuclear power station, you make sure the national grid is safe, you know, the simple thing that you would do in any health and safety in a children's home or a small company.
Well, until this Conservative government, or rather that it was the coalition to begin with, came into office, there was no national security advisor pulling it all together. There is now. The national security strategy, the first draft, as I say, I didn't think was very good. It didn't mention we were an island, to my astonishment. But the point was, nobody had done one before. And that document, which has been renewed several times, is now quite a good document. We now have a very effective cyber network to protect specifically against cyber threats. The Rotterdam attack would have been much less successful against the British, or a cyber attack would have been less successful. And now, 18 months ago, the UK resilience framework document is another step forward. So little by little, we are moving forward on it. But the kind of way that your viewers can encourage this process is by writing to the paper, by writing to their members of parliament, by saying, what is your interest in national resilience, by pressing them on their interest in defence. I firmly believe that we need to spend more money on defence, but I also believe that that will achieve very little unless more of it is spent on reserve forces and on the wider network. We need to find ways. I mean, you look at Ukraine. Within a week or two of the invasion, you had a small business which was producing radio masts for telecommunications, converting its process into producing tank traps, which are made of much the same kind of materials. You need to see, defence can't just be, as it's been for much too long, about regular forces and the existing defence industry. It has to be about engaging the country as a whole, which Ukraine is pretty good at. Otherwise, it would have lost very early on.
And it seems to say Finland is, because everybody's got a family member that's in the reserves, I think, let's move on to what we can all do now. Yes. Because we've sort of identified what the government has and has not done, and because your eyes are glistening with the spaceship yes. thing underneath as an alien from the Northern Lights, let's talk about that for a second, because that actually goes again. There is something that the Aurora Borealis brings, if it's strong enough, that can disrupt yes. all our lives. Explain that.
Yes. It's sometimes called a Carrington event, because that was the name given to the incident in the 19th century when the Victorians suddenly found in large parts of the world that the telegraph wires had all been fried. And now a Carrington event, which is basically an extreme example of a solar-driven electrical storm where solar plasma detaches itself and reaches our atmosphere, our ionosphere, that wouldn't affect under the Earth cables, but it certainly would take out large amounts of our communication system, and would be a threat potentially to power lines as well. you mentioned, I think my colleague Oliver Letwin's book, Apocalypse Yes. Now, where he looked at that. And actually, the dangers from that natural event would be very similar to some of the man-made dangers that we saw in attacks like the Rotterdam attack and a number of the cyber attacks we've had on the NHS in this country. But
The magnetic storm, the electromagnetic pulse, I think it's called.
Yeah.
They're talking about a lot about warfare in space. So that could also be replicated or fabricated by somebody letting a nuclear bomb off in space, couldn't it?
Yes. The effect of letting a nuclear bomb off in space would be to fry the communications over at least half the world's surface if it was done in the right place. But even short of a nuclear bomb, and this is where we get into much more immediate threats, there's a lot of damage that can be done in space, which is deniable by having spacecraft that just accidentally bump into key communications satellites, or even just happen to accidentally blow up and in the process produce lots of fragments which interfere with communication, spacecraft, and so on. Quite a lot of damage can be done. We saw this with undersea cables we still don't know the crucial, the damage to the oil supply, the North Sea undersea oil supply to Germany. We still don't know for certain that that was Russia. They're still denying it. In the same way, the same thing can happen in outer space. It's possible to have deniable damage. Which
and is that in the resilience report that you mentioned that the government had? Is space included in that?
To be absolutely honest, Humphrey, I've forgotten whether it gets into space. But it certainly gets into at some length, cyber threats and so on. And the potential dangers from space are included certainly in wider work that's been done on the cyber side. And as I've already mentioned, cyber is the area where the government has gone furthest in providing resilience. Yeah. But there's also stuff that every household can do.
Well, that's exactly what I get going on. I've made a list, but I'm not going to say, give me your list of what I should do in my household, Julian.
Well, the first thing I'd do is I would say, what happened the last time I had a power cut? What went off and how did it affect me? Now, the power cut, of course, means that you've lost the internet. But it also means you've lost heat and light and so on. You need to think about the things that you're going to need. Some of the most obvious things are torches and spare batteries. You need to have a radio that will work without mains power, which means batteries. And it's not at all expensive to get battery chargers, which you can either wind up by hand or use solar power to charge up. So those are solutions for batteries, because you'll need a radio if you've got no internet. You need to have it shouldn't be an entirely selfish process, this. Communities can be more resilient if people are willing to be generous about it. COVID was an awful experience, but one good thing that came out of it was it reminded us how important communities are. And there are lots of voluntary organizations people can join. At the sort of wider level, you've got the St. John's Ambulance, you've got the Red Cross, and so on. More locally, Salvation Army and my own church, Catholic Church's St. Vincent de Paul Society, were delivering parcels. I was a volunteer driver for them during COVID to local people in need. And as an individual household, you can just remember that Granny, who is in an isolated lane if you're in the countryside, or perhaps living on her own in the block of flats you live in a city, that there's an individual old person there who may actually be cold and frightened if the power goes off. And it'll be the same people, typically, it's still relatively recent, as were alone and a bit cold and frightened during COVID.
So we need torches with batteries, not torches that we have to plug in to get recharged. I presume the mobile phones won't work either, because the cell masts will be down as well. So we need a way to communicate with people.
That's right. You can get signals from the government and local radio. Forgive me teasing your former employer, Humphrey, but one of the many things I used to fight the BBC over was the way they constantly seemed to want to cut BBC local radio, which is magnificent. In my view, together with the World Service, is the best bit of the BBC, because, exactly. Of course, they are the first port of call, yeah, in terms of getting messages as to what to do and so on for people in communities. As far as communicating outwards is concerned, it's not actually expensive to buy a two-way radio. But the more important end of it is being able to get messages from the BBC local radio and so on.
Right, and if we take a sort of standard community, you would have institutions with backup generators, wouldn't you? So the fire station, the police station, the BBC local radio, which would, I presume, then be sort of places to meet, gathering points, or?
Yes. I mean, little by little, the government has moved us on. I mean, in 2010, there was almost no emergency planning was basically confined to local authorities, and there were some experiments for what was called MACA, military aid to the civilian authority. Those have moved on quite a long way. Again, that's an area where reservists can help. Our regular military are increasingly concentrated on small numbers of very large bases, typically a long way away from our main population centres. The people who actually know where to go and where to help are typically reserve units in those population centres. But we now have all these various new forms of planning developing, which I've mentioned. But one of the things they do need to do is to get local authorities more organised to actually cope with these issues. And again, this is something which your viewers can do. They can ask their local authority to see the emergency plan. If they're in a rural area or on a parish council, the parish council can press the local authority both to see that plan and also to know how they can contribute to it.
Can I ask our audience, our live audience with us now, are any of you on a parish council? Do any of you know or teach first aid, take first aid courses? Anybody got any thoughts on this for your community? Put it in the chat and Julian and I will whisk it around to see where it goes. Because what I don't want to do in this conversation is take in that sort of thing you see in American movies, the survivalists that have these cellars that are bomb-proof full of food. We don't have to do that, do we?
Well, I certainly hope not. Margaret Thatcher, I remember, got into a bit of trouble on this because she said sensible people do keep a certain amount of backup of food. We don't all need to dig cellars, and the majority of people aren't in a position to do so anyway, but having some reserves of food is useful. And of course, one of the things that in some of the worst crises that we would lose is access to clean drinking water. Now, there's a very cheap and easy way to cope for that for several weeks, which is much easier than trying to stockpile bottled water, which is an expensive thing to do and also very bulky, which is to have some water sterilizing tablets. They're extremely small. They're very cheap. You can have several weeks' supply. The problem is not normally accessing water. You can get water from puddles if you sterilize them for an hour before drinking them. So a little backup of water sterilizing tablets is valuable too.
And personally for ourselves now, I've mentioned first aid. How important is it for us all to know that, and how much should we know?
I'm strongly in favour of people doing first aid courses, and both the British Red Cross and St John's Ambulance and a number of other organisations offer first aid courses. I'm in favour of children being taught about it at school. Something we haven't mentioned yet is the Army cadets and air cadets and sea cadets. They have access to first aid courses. There is first aid taught on the Duke of Edinburgh's award scheme, which again is something which is really good for developing resilience in young people. But being able to cope if you're in a crisis makes a very big difference. To take an extreme example, the Manchester bombing, the presence of first aiders, the response of the statutory services was, it's no exaggeration to say, extremely poor. And the report was very clear on that. Motivated firemen and ambulance people who wanted to deploy weren't allowed into the area. They weren't allowed through the cordon while people died. The presence of first aiders on the scene and the fact that the one or two of the firearms police who were allowed to deploy had first aid qualifications helped save lives.
So it's because actually I have to reveal something that after first chatting to you about this, Julian, I have now booked myself onto a refresher first aid course because I realized I was a little out of date with it. And every time you see somebody being mugged or a knife attack or something like that, you think, would I be able to handle that situation? So July the 3rd, I'm doing a Red Cross first aid course for £60. So, and I think that'd be well worth it.
I'm going to interrupt and say you put me to shame. My wife is fully up to date on first aid. I'm not. I must do one. Yes.
Come and join me July 3rd. I think they still got a space in Moorgate, London or something that I've booked up for. And we're running out of time, but I just want to talk about in our individual health, because if we are, you know, if we're unhealthy, then we can't help many people. How important is that, Julian?
It's absolutely crucial. In any crisis, the difference between resilience and robustness is about doing what we expect to do well and being fit for it. Resilience is being able to cope with the unexpected. And it's people who are mentally and physically fit who are best able to cope with these problems. And this is something which at all stages and with all positions in life, people can do more of. I mean, I saw only a year or so ago that a survey of people aged over 80 who regularly bicycled more than three times a week, they had resistance to illness that was better than the national average. There are, you know, I have a number of friends who are disabled in wheelchairs, and by making efforts to keep themselves physically fit, they are much better able to cope with crises. And there's also a big crossover being shown again and again between physical fitness and regular exercise and a healthy diet on the one hand, and mental fitness and ability to cope with stress and strain in life. Because, of course, at the heart of resilience is coping with stress. I remember when I did selection all those years ago for my regiment, the great thing they used to say to us again and again and again is, it's all in the mind.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's sort of keeping calm and carrying on, I think. You know, that sort of thing is that. And then if you know, worst comes to the worst, our communities are struck, and they were in Ukraine a couple of years back, still are now. But in the Second World War, you had the Blitz that suddenly came like that, didn't it? And the communities. And all we get from that, I think, we would all quote Dad's Army, wouldn't we? But it's not that, is it?
No. The Home Defence Force, the Dad's Army, as it was called, had a role to play. And my great-grandfather, as an old man, used to go out with his shotgun, literally rather like the programmes on the television. And of course, the controller of BBC One then was a former bomber pilot, if I remember rightly, who authorized it. But the what it's about is a willingness to, well, first of all, the government needs to recognize, and step by step, it's starting to do so. And I hope the all parts in Parliament will pick up the... It's about engaging the nation, recognising that protecting our nation, whether from man-made threats or natural ones, is about the nation as a whole. It's not just about the regular armed forces. But at the level of the individual, it's about the great JFK commentary. It's not about asking, what can my country do for me? It's about asking, what can I do for my country, for my community, for my household, for my neighbours?
That is such a good thought. I'm going to finish our podcast recording on that, because Time's Winged Chariot is attacking us. For our live audience, stay with us, because we are going to stop recording and we can have a free-for-all conversation directly with Julian. But thank you for giving us brilliant insight, that step-by-step thing. I've got first aid, stay healthy, back up the computers, radios, torches, a few foods for us, water sterilizing tablets I put in there. And thank you for those comments and questions. The next podcast is Lucinda with Jane Corrie, best-selling author and a writer in residence at a high-security prison. Next week is Goals to Book Club, which is unrecorded. That's Laura Cumming on Chapel Sands. Until we meet again, recommend joining the reserves to friends, family, even enemies, colleagues. Stay active, be curious, be generous, get prepared in little ways, batteries and first aid, and of course, stay Goldster. Thank you, Julian. Thank you, everyone. And goodbye for the podcast.
Thank you, Humphrey.
You've been listening to a Goldster Magazine Show podcast. Check us out on www.goldster.co.uk. We hope to tempt you, your family, and friends into the exciting world of helping everyone live healthier and happier for longer. Find more podcasts just by Googling Goldster and podcast. I'm Humphrey Hawksley, and hope you're with us again soon.